The Christmas truce, a remarkable event 105 years ago, although it's happened several times since, but on Christmas Eve, 1914, a spontaneous ceasefire was observed across the whole of the Western Front. The Christmas truce of the First World War was an extraordinary event in the history of warfare. Initially, it received widespread media coverage in the New York Times of 31 December 1914, followed by British newspapers such as The Mirror, The Illustrated London News, and The Times, which printed front-page photographs of British and German troops mingling and singing Christmas carols. And Christmas truce at the front, right up at the front, stories told in letters from the trenches to the Daily Mail, and snowballs and jokes with the foe, all kinds of interesting responses from what's going on there. An historic group, British and German soldiers photographed together, and as I said, photographic evidence of the Christmas truce. London Illustrated News showed how it actually began with a German soldier walking over with a Christmas tree with candles on it to the British after them joining in singing Silent Night. And at first this was received very well. But the French government was the first to severely censor any reports on what they called fraternization with the enemy. When I went to the Imperial War Museum last in 2014, it was for the 100th anniversary of the launch of the First World War, and I was speaking at a conference nearby, and the Imperial War Museum had extraordinary exhibits. All across the main floor, they had World War War exhibits. And I was amazed to see that the Christmas truce is now openly acknowledged at the Imperial War Museum in London, with photographs of German and British troops celebrating Christmas together. These photographs were censored for most of the last century. But here it is in the British Imperial War Museum. By the end of 1914, the exhausted armies had sought safety in trenches. In the opposing front lines, men endured the same wretched conditions, often within earshot of one another. At Christmas, German and British soldiers emerged to meet in a frozen strip of mud between the trenches. They sang carols and exchanged presents from cigarettes and cigars to buttons and badges. But this seasonal goodwill could not last. And they had photographs, including this picture and these details. Hate propaganda against the wicked Hun began as soon as Britain went to war. The press was full of tales of German atrocities, both real and imagined. In this poisoned atmosphere, angry crowds smashed windows of shops owned by Germans, and British authorities interned German men in camps. Actually, interned German women too. It was, according to a poem by Rudyard Kipling, the most popular British writer at the time, when the English began to hate. So even in the British and Imperial War Museum, they were admitting that they had hate propaganda. In fact, Rudyard Kipling says, "If any ask why our children died, tell them their fathers lied." And Rudyard Kipling lied to mobilize the British to war, lied. He was part of the British propaganda department. He also lied to get his son, who was not, didn't have good eyesight and shouldn't have been in a frontline position, to get him in a frontline position. And his son died specifically because of his bad eyesight and losing his glasses in the fight and stumbled towards the wrong side. So his son died because his father lied. And Rudyard Kipling acknowledged this, his only son. Reports of German atrocities were often lurid and false. This included stories of mutilated nuns, butchered babies, but people were all too ready to believe them. In Britain, there was a cleansing of all things German or German-sounding. London's Coburg Hotel was renamed the Cognault. German shepherd dogs became Alsatians. German measles became Belgian thrush. Orchestras stopped playing Beethoven and Wagner. It was worse than that. They stoned German dogs, such as sausage dogs, to death. They were brutal, and it wasn't just in England. In Cape Town, there were mobs that went and burned out German bakeries and butcheries in downtown Cape Town. And they locked up tens of thousands of people just because their ancestry was German. This was as far afield as in Natal and all over the world. Political pressure was brought to bear to censor all reports of the event from mainstream history books for decades. for years, this extraordinary event was known only by word of mouth from participants. Now, I heard it because I've met people when I was a lot younger who'd fought in the First World War. Of course, everyone who fought in the First World War is dead now. But I met and spoke with them, and some of them told me at MOTH meetings, Memorial Order of the Tin Hat, of the Christmas truce. And I was a little skeptical because I'd never seen it depicted in film, never heard it, it wasn't in the history books. And in fact, I even started in the 1970s and 80s to see reports that some claimed there was a Christmas truce, but that's false. And so this was in school textbooks, this was in the media. For something like 80 years, they suppressed this about the Christmas truce until virtually everyone who had been involved in it had died, and out came the letters. The damage caused by Christmas truce to propaganda campaigns to demonize the enemy was regarded as a serious threat to the war effort. It has taken decades to unearth the details of the fascinating events surrounding Christmas 1914. In fact, it's been called the Christmas Miracle. And now books are coming out, and even the British and Imperial War Museum has to admit it. And now you get stories like The Silent Night, the story of the Christmas truce in World War I, the moving story of horror taking a holiday. In the first 5 months of the Great War, they didn't call it World War I because they didn't know there was going to be a second. It was meant to be the war to end all wars. It was called the Great War at the time. In the first 5 months of the Great War, over 1 million Europeans had already been killed in action. 1 million in 5 months. And the politicians had promised them on all sides the war will be over by Christmas. Well, most of those had died of artillery fire. Well over 60% of the deaths were from artillery fire. The initial fast-moving campaigns had degenerated into static trench warfare with a continuous front line of barbed wire trenches stretching from the North Sea to the Swiss frontier across the whole of Belgium and France. There was this continuous, and when we're talking about a trench, multiple layers and layers and layers of trenches. Emily Hobhouse, beloved heroine in South Africa, was the most prominent campaign against British involvement in the First World War. It was the famous Englishwoman Emily Hobhouse who had exposed to the world the horrors of Lord Kitchener's scorched earth campaign against the Boer republics and of the Transvaal and Orange Free State, and the horrors of the British concentration camps in South Africa. Scorched earth, 30,000 farms destroyed, dynamited, burned, with the British even taking photographs of them burning and bombing farms. Like here, you can see the beginning of it starting to explode, the remains of it. This is the man who became Prime Minister Louis Botha, first Prime Minister, but when he was General Louis Botha, his home being dynamited by British troops, and they took pictures of it. They were so proud of it. Here's the interior of the ruined Dutch Reformed Church in Ventersburg, burned by British forces. These were documented by Emily Hobhouse. Because of her, we have these photographs, pictures, and portraits. On the night of 2nd of February 1902, a British column burned down the church in Lindley. Why, you may ask? Concentration camps in the wilderness, where they just put people in the middle of winter in thin Bell army tents, which was no protection against the elements. Nuvelspont concentration camp. And as you can see, spot the tree. I mean, it's just like none, nothing. The grim plight of those held at the Bloemfontein concentration camp. These are all pictures taken by Emily Hobhouse and made known to the world by her. Children at Bloemfontein concentration camp. Anna Daval and her daughter performing domestic chores outside the tent. Even the captions are from Emily Hobhouse. Orphans at Nuvelspont concentration camp. More orphans, the innocent casualties of war. Again, I'm taking the captions from Emily Hobhouse. Now, you can see pictures like these at Bloemfontein Anglo-Boer War Museum of starved children. Here's an 18-year-old, Miss Botha of Lady Brunt, who died with the desire that the fear cloud be draped around her chest after death. Gijsbert Johannes Vermeulen, 12 years old, died in the Bloemfontein concentration camp. You know, people talk about concentration camps of the Second World War, but there was a greater death toll in the British concentration camps in the Anglo-Boer War. As Emily Hobhouse documented, a quarter of the total population of each camp died each year. That means in 4 years, they'd all be dead. And yet the people who survived 13 years in concentration camps in the Second World War, indicating that they had a lower death rate than the British camps had in South Africa during the Anglo-Boer War, with a deliberate keeping the food so low to have the deliberate intention that they would starve out. That was the intention, to break the will to bring the men to the peace table. Lizzie Van Zyl, holding the porcelain doll given her by Emily Hobhouse. Jaap van den Berg outside the tent where he died in Bloemfontein concentration camp. Just these and many more were made known to the world by Emily Hobhouse, and so she is the one who revealed to the world the horrors of scorched earth and concentration camp policies, of what the British government called refugees. But as was pointed out, it plainly said prisoners of war in Dutch and in English, warning that they will be shot if they go out. So this is not a refugee camp when you're told you're going to be shot if you leave. These prints, these of watercolours done by Emily Hobhouse of the Lindley Church burned out, homes destroyed, the cemeteries outside camps, the process of scorched earth. This is now needlework, which you can see at the Anglo-Boer War Museum. The concentration camps, the burials, overwhelmingly women and children, and the depictions of the camps. She was called that English woman. She's the one who authored the open Christmas letter calling for peace. Towards the end of November 1914, 101 British women signed Emily's open Christmas letter, which was issued and endorsed by 155 prominent German and Austrian women in response. Under the heading, On Earth, Peace, Goodwill Towards Men, Emily Hobhouse wrote, "Sisters, the Christmas message sounds like mockery to a world at war. But those of us who wished, and still wish, for peace, may surely offer a solemn greeting to such of you who feel as we do." She mentioned that as in South Africa during the Anglo-Boer War, the brunt of modern war falls upon non-combatants, and the conscience of the world cannot bear the sight. And here's a rewriting of that letter. And some of the famous names of prominent women in England who signed this, and Emily Hobhouse first up. Now, Emily Hobhouse was the daughter of a minister. She had a relative in Parliament. She was well-connected. She was from a very respected branch of British upper classes, and therefore she was almost untouchable, but she is regarded as a traitor by the British people, because she opposed and exposed the atrocities in the Anglo-Boer War and did the same in the First. "Is it not our mission to preserve life?" she wrote. "Do not humanity and common sense alike prompt us to join hands with the women and urge our rulers to stave off further bloodshed? May Christmas hasten that day." The German mothers responded, "To us English sisters, sisters of the same race, our warm and heartfelt thanks for Christmas greetings. Women of the belligerent countries, with all faithfulness, devotion, and love to their country, can go beyond it and maintain true solidarity with the women of other belligerent nations, that really civilized women never lose their humanity." Emily Hobhouse also oversaw the raising of funds and shipping of food and medicines to the women and children of Austria and Germany who were being starved by the hunger blockade, the naval blockade. Germany's only route to the colonies and the rest of the world was through this narrow area, which soon was saturated with sea mines. All the dark and blue areas are where the sea mines were, to provide small areas for the Royal Navy to patrol. And so they were being effectively starved into resistance. It's been pointed out that while Germany won the land battles, Britain won the sea battles because the colossal navy, which no one could match, and basically starved the nation of raw materials and ultimately of food. Germany being so industrialized, they could not provide enough food for their people. In the British Imperial War Museum, I saw this picture. I've seen another place, but that the British are now acknowledging the starving children in Vienna, Austria. through her efforts, of course, she couldn't get any food shipped to them across the seas, but she could get neutral countries like Sweden and Switzerland pay for food from there to be shipped into Austria and Switzerland. Thousands of women and children starving in Germany and Austria because of the British naval blockade were fed by the support she was able to channel to them. So this was a woman who believed in action. As she channeled aid to the women and children suffering in the British concentration camps, brought pressure to bear on the politicians like Lord Alfred Milner and Kitchener, who were inflicting these barbarous policies, what was called methods of barbarism, she saved lives. Numerous ministers were proclaiming from the pulpit that the guns may fall silent at least upon the night when the angels sang. Very famously, both Lord Milner and Kitchener referred to her as that bloody woman. Well, although these messages from Emily Hobhouse and those ministers who agreed with her were officially rebuffed and suppressed in the heavily censored media, many of the soldiers on the front line seemed to share the sentiments. Whether they heard of it by word of mouth, Bush Telegraph or whatever, or whether it was just that they had the same sentiments anyway. From the first week of December, informal truces were observed by soldiers on the front line. In a letter dated 7 December 1914, Charles de Gaulle expressed his dismay at the fraternization with the enemy, where French and German troops had exchanged newspapers, recovered their dead, and organized burial parties in no man's land. French General de Herbel expressed alarm over soldiers staying too long in the same sector, because then they became friendly with the enemies to the extent they were conducting conversations between lines and even visiting one another's trenches. After heavy rains near Ypres in Belgium, where the Germans held the high ground and the British the lower ground, English troops came out of their flooded trenches in full view of the Germans, who just expressed their sympathy and did not open fire on their soaked and vulnerable enemy. Now, this may seem awfully strange to people who haven't been in that situation, but the elements can sometimes be so great that the soldiers in the trenches, facing the same afflictions, foot rot and all the rest of it, they felt more sympathy with the enemy in trenches than they did for the politicians back home and shipped them there. They didn't see the men they were fighting as the enemy, they saw the politicians back home as the real enemy. The 2nd Essex Regiment recorded on the 11th of December in their war diary that their officers' men met the German Saxon Corps halfway between the trenches and exchanged food, cigarettes, chocolates, and conversations. As was pointed out, the French had the best wine, Germans had the best chocolates, the British had the best pies, and so there was this kind of like exchanging around. Some people's ration packs had one item too many of this, and others had none of that, and so they were happily swapping around ration packs. And I mean, you get some of the spirit of Christmas in this picture here. Here's an interesting card that came from King George V of England, who would have been the grandfather of the present Queen Elizabeth. With our best wishes for Christmas 1914, may God protect you and bring you home safe. On Christmas Eve, German soldiers began decorating the trenches with Christmas trees and candles. In fact, the Kaiser created a logistical challenge by instructing that every soldier needs presents, needs their mail, they need cooked hot meals on Christmas Eve, and he ordered so many Christmas trees that they basically had Christmas trees every 2 meters along the whole of the front line. And so the Germans were awash with presents and with Christmas trees, creating massive pileups. The amount of railway carriages required for the distribution of these was extraordinary. The Christmas truce began in the region of Ypres in Belgium, where the Germans were enthusiastically singing Christmas carols in their trenches. When the British soldiers joined in singing Silent Night, I mean, everyone around the world should recognize the tune, they then responded with carols of their own, and the two sides began shouting Christmas greetings to one another. So here's one letter again from the English War Museum. They finished their carol, and we thought that we ought to retaliate in some way, so we sang the first Noel. When we finished that, they all began clapping. Then they struck up another favorite of theirs, O Tannenbaum, Christmas tree. And so it went on. First the Germans would sing one of their carols, and we would sing one of ours. And when we started, O Come All Ye Faithful, the Germans immediately joined and sing the same hymn to the Latin words, Asta Fidelis. And I thought, well, this is really the most extraordinary thing. Two nations both sing the same carols in the middle of a war. And that's from one British soldier's letters. Shortly after that, soldiers spontaneously came out of their trenches and walked across no man's land to greet one another, exchanging gifts and souvenirs. In some cases, swapping hats and badges and all the rest. All started with Silent Night and a Christmas tree at Ypres, as far as the reconstruction goes. This truce spread rapidly across the entire Western Front, with over 100,000 German and British troops involved in this unofficial cessation of fighting. And here's just some of the pictures. Now, here's in somebody's scrapbook, Xmas 1914, a friendly chat with the enemy. And these pictures get quite confusing because you get people wearing different uniforms with mismatching hats and of one another, because they were swapping hats around. And so you really got to look carefully to realize who's who, because sometimes the person wearing a British hat's German, the person wearing a German hat's English. Soon Australian, New Zealand, Canadian, Belgian and French troops joined in the Christmas celebrations in the frozen strip of no man's land. And joint worship services were held. And respectful burial services were conducted by the combatants for the dead between their lines. And you can still see, I've been up into the battlefronts and received guidance from the frontline tours of Lionel Rosamont, who lives near Ypres. Soldiers swapped ration packs, wine, pies, chocolate, souvenirs, buttons, badges and hats. There's even a story of this one Frenchman who had taken as a souvenir one of the Germans' helmets, and they had these ones with nice spikes. And when they had inspection the other side, the man walked across no man's land, asked, could I get my hat back? And French soldier gave it to him, and later he came back and brought that hat. And there was ridiculous scenes like this taking place. Friendly encounters between the lines. Foes and trenches swapped pies for wine. And past season's compliments. English and Saxon officers photographed together between the hostile trenches. The daily graphic, British and Germans, the truce of Christmas. Pictorial proof of Christmas Day truce showing Britain and German friends between the trenches in Belgium. Phenomenal as it may appear that soldiers can fight to the death one day and fraternize the next. It is, after all, only strictly in accordance with human nature. I disagree. This is not in accordance with human nature. This is a uniquely Christian event. If the soldiers on both sides weren't Christians, sing the same hymns, worshipping the same Christ, it wouldn't have happened. This isn't human nature. This is something spiritual. And again, you see here the confusion of uniforms as everyone's swapping. And here are some non-commissioned officers on the British side with souvenirs of Christmas truce, including the pointed helmet, famous pointed helmets of the Prussian or German side. And some German soldiers showing some of their loot that they've collected from the British side. The next day, football matches were played between the lines. British officer Robert Grays wrote of the football match between the 133 Saxon regiment and the Scottish troops. And there's a variety of games that were reported. The Germans won 3-2 in that match. The Glasgow News on 2nd of January reported that the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders won their match 4-1. Royal Field Artillery Lieutenant Albert Wynne wrote of their soccer match against the Hanoverians near Ypres on Christmas Day. And here's a memorial, one crown, that came out on the 100th anniversary of this. We will remember them, showing the opposing sides with their rifles stacked, their helmets on the ground, playing football together with the poppy. Very symbolic. Commanders threatened repercussions for lack of discipline, and numerous officers ordered their artillery to open fire on the fraternizing troops in no man's land. This meant killing their own troops along with the enemies. And the artillery officers very wisely and understandably refused. On none of the occasions did the artillery obey these orders. There are numerous complaints on record by officers shocked at the total breakdown of discipline, as men point blank refused orders to open fire on their own soldiers mingling with the enemy in no man's land on Christmas Day. The Christian sentiment was so strong that even when given an order by the officer, open fire, men did not, because but it's Christmas. And they celebrate, we can't do this. General Sir Horace Smith Dorrien commanded the British Second Corps, which was the bulk of the forces in particularly Belgium, but also France. Horace Smith Dorrien was one of the very few British survivors of the Battle of East Luanda during the Anglo-Zulu War of 1879. So he's super lucky to have been alive, and you would have thought he'd know something more about grace, but unfortunately he was the one who issued orders forbidding fraternization with the enemy, and he complained that his orders were disregarded by the soldiers, and he court-martialed a number of people for engaging in this. Richard Skirman was so impressed by the camaraderie experienced between his German regiment and the French soldiers during the Christmas truce that they even exchanged addresses with one another, that he went on to found the Youth Hostel Association in 1919 to provide meeting places where young men of all countries could get to know one another. And that starts from that Christmas truce. What may surprise many people is there was also a general observance of a Christmas truce on the Eastern Front. In fact, that was an even bigger truce and a longer truce than the Western Front truce. German, Austrian, Hungarian, and Russian commanders ordered ceasefires for the duration of Christmas, but on the Eastern Front, that's longer. Because we have Christmas celebrated on 24th, 25th of December, but the Russians celebrate Christmas on the 6th of January. In fact, they have 12 days leading up to it too, and the Eastern Orthodox calendar, their Christmas is 6th January, ours is 24th, 25th of December. And so, effectively, Eastern Front orders were from the Russian, Austrian, and German high commands, no offensive actions. No offensive actions, unless fired upon, you will not engage in any offensive actions. And so, across the entire Eastern Front, there was, and Austrians, Germans, and Russians came and danced with one another, and there was on the ice and the snow. And by the way, the only breach on the Eastern Front was the Serbians. The Serbians, who started the war, one of the terrorists is the one who murdered the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, they would not observe it, and they opened fire. So the Austrians were fighting on the Serbian front, but the rest of the front with Russia was completely peaceful for more than 2 weeks. Numerous French and British officers were court-martialed for participating in this fraternization with the enemy. Whole units had to be pulled back from the front and sent to other fronts when they displayed reluctance to fire on the enemy who they'd celebrate Christmas with. In fact, there's some extraordinary events where they would, if they had to fire, they would shoot in the air over the other side's heads, where they would come across and inform them, we're very sorry, but we've got to open fire with artillery this afternoon at 2. If you can, you can come to our trenches, and they, all the Germans would move over to the French or the British trenches for the artillery barrage, and then later, well, you know, we're going to reply. So they all went over to those. And they had for quite a while this kind of arrangement to miss one another. Numerous artillerians began to fire only at precise locations at prearranged times to avoid causing casualties to the other side. And as a result of many instances of soldiers firing high and ineffectually, this was reported in the end. Entire units were taken away from the front. The Germans shipped their people to the Eastern Front because they were useless now in fighting the British and French. Now they knew the people on the other side were Christians. And the British troops who wouldn't find a German, they said, we were told they were evil. We're fighting for Christian civilization. They've got Gott mit uns, God with us, on their belt buckles. And they sing Christmas carols, celebrating Christmas. They had to ship them off to fight the Turks in Gallipoli and Iraq because there were no use anymore on the Western Front. Units had to be shoveled around all over the place because the men, having celebrated Christmas with the other side, could no longer fight them. Now, most people don't know that there was also quite a few places where Christmas truces were observed in 1915. An Easter Sunday truce was also attempted by German units in 1915, but these were repressed by British artillery fire. In November 1915, a Saxon unit briefly fraternized with the Liverpool Battalion and conducted burial services together in no man's land. In December 1915, there were explicit orders directed by Allied commanders, elaborate procedures made to forestall any repeat of the previous Christmas truce, including bombardments throughout Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. But even the multiple artillery barrages ordered across the entire front line throughout Christmas Day by the British were not completely effective, and a number of truces were observed in the Western Front's Christmas 1915 as well. And you can tell because these people are wearing helmets. There were no helmets in 1914. Helmets only came in 1915. In some sectors of the Western Front, carols and gifts were exchanged between British and German troops in 1915. At least one football match with about 50 soldiers on each side was recorded in 1915. Sir Ian Callaghan of the Scots Guards was court-martialed for defying orders by maintaining a short truce to bury the dead between the lines on Christmas Day 1915. But because he was related to the British Prime Minister H.H. Asquith, his punishment was commuted and he was not shot as was planned, but he was put in a punishment battalion. German attempts to observe Christmas truces in December 1916 and 1917 were also rebuffed by British artillery barrages. But recent evidence has come to light of a successful Christmas truce in 1916 between German and Canadian soldiers near Vimy Ridge, where they exchanged Christmas greetings and presents. The Canadians and Germans visited one another's lines on 25 December 1916. And here's one of these testimonies that has come to light. Somebody found in an attic of their uncle in Canada about the Christmas truce observed in the Ypres salient 1916. This is what these places look like. It's still, you can see the upheavals of the pockmarked landscape from the artillery bombardments. And, you know, when you see a lot of depictions of no man's land, if you've seen films like Flyboys, where this chap decides to land between the lines, you couldn't land an aircraft between lines. It's just totally, it would have been worse than this. This is what it looks like 100 years later. You can't land an aircraft, let alone take off an aircraft, between the lines where they've been pouring millions of tons of artillery barrages around one another. For example, just in the run-up to the Battle of Passchendaele, British artillery placed 5 tons of high explosive on every square meter of the area they were going to attack into across a 10-mile front. So 5 tons of high explosive in a 1-meter area. What do you think that's going to be? Look like a flat surface for an aircraft to land on. And so the stories are coming out of the incredible Christmas truces of World War One. It may surprise some people to know that several famous authors, such as C.S. Lewis of the Narnia series, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, for example, fought on the Western Front. And J.R.R. Tolkien, who was born in Bloemfontein, South Africa, who wrote Lord of the Rings, he also fought on the Western Front. They brought out a film recently on Tolkien. A.A. Milne, the creator of Winnie the Pooh, also fought on the Western Front. And they experienced Christmas truces as well. A Christmas truce memorial was unveiled in Freylagen in France on 11 November 2008 at the spot where 25 December 1914, the Royal Welsh Fusiliers had played football with the German 371 Battalion, which they recorded the Germans 1-2-1. And here is a French report of the English, the Germans, the Belgians, and the French commemorating the truce of Christmas 1914. And there were various reenactors gathering, and military history tours offered Christmas truce guided tours, and I've had these as well up in Ypres. And this is the killing grounds at Ypres. And this is where Australian troops were opposite German troops, Australians on this side, Germans on the other. And it was across this field that a lot of the fighting took place. And notice people bring footballs and wreaths to remember. And here the Khaki Chums, meaning Aussies, came in 1999 on the 85th anniversary, some of those who still survived, and laid wreaths and soccer balls there to remember this. You've got some Australian and flags planted in there as well. And lo and behold, I saw Felix, or is it Nesta's great-great-great-great-grandchild, you might recall in the Christmas Truce film, Joyeux Noël, there's this cat who's called Nesta by the French and Felix by the Germans. And no, it's Nesta. No, it's Felix. No, it's Nesta. And, well, here's his relative still around. Would you believe that the scene that they depict in the film, where this officer says, I've received an instruction to have the cat court-martialed and shot for fraternizing with the enemy. That isn't a joke. That's not Hollywood. It actually happened. The French High Command issued an order for the cat that was going between the lines to be court-martialed for fraternizing enemy and shot. I hope the cat escaped, but the order actually came. Now, you can immediately tell the difference between German trenches and British trenches. These are German, these are British. Difference? German trenches were curved. British trenches were at right angles. Now, why you don't have a straight strip? Well, because if a artillery barrage lands at any one place, you don't want to wipe out everybody in the trench, so the curves are meant to limit the blast of an unlucky shot, mortar, or shell landing within it. The Germans tended to use wicker, wood type lining. The British did use wood, but there were times towards the end where they were actually using corrugated iron to hold it up from mudslides. This is a German war cemetery at Ypres, Langemark. And you can see here, I have called you by name, you are mine. Isaiah 43 verse 1. All gave some gave all. Now in the British speaking world, we observe 11 November as Remembrance Day. And the moths, the Memorial Order, the Tin Hats have the slogan of, at the going down the sun and in the morning we will remember them. Here's more reenactors gathering with German and British soldiers at the actual venues where they had the Christmas cruises, and of course they had to have soccer matches. I think basically soccer in Europe is an alternative to war. If you can play soccer with enemy, and of course it's better, less bloodshed, you know, things like this, got more chance of survival. And so they've even got monuments like this of the British and German troops meeting, shaking hands over a soccer ball. This is quite appropriate.
That British person is offside.
Uh-huh. The 2005 French film Joyeux Noël dramatizes the Christmas truce of 1914 through the eyes of French, Scottish and German soldiers on the Western Front. A generally good film. I've got a short clip of a key part of it to show at the end. But in 2014, Sainsbury, which is a British department store, brought out a wonderful trailer in tribute to the Christmas truce, and they used war reenactors who knew the uniforms and weapons and everything else, and it was very well put together on the Christmas truce and very meaningful. And you can hear throughout it the strains of the hymn in the background. We'll get a chance to see that later. These are other photographs you get to see in the war museums. Like, this is obviously later on when they had helmets. It's probably near Verdun in 1916, because they both use wearing helmets. But you see German troops helping a French enemy out of the mud where he is sinking in. I mean, the morass caused by the artillery barrage was colossal. And extraordinary how German and French troops gather at the same venue in Verdun, where they wiped out hundreds of thousands of one another in one of the bloodiest battles of the war. Because the fields of Flanders, where so many British soldiers died, which in fact they said 85% of the British army was killed or knocked out of action before Christmas in 1914. So in the first 5 months of the war, they'd lost 85% of the British army. That's why they had to raise an entirely new one. And almost all the British casualties were in Belgium. And just within a 10-kilometer radius of Ypres, there are 165 British and Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries. I counted over 65 Hammonds on the walls of these war cemeteries, and I only got to six of the biggest when I visited there first several years ago. And so I contacted the British and Commonwealth War Graves Commission, and they informed me that over 480 Hammonds died in the First World War. Just our family name. And of course, you shouldn't forget the horses and the dogs who were trained for war there, who died in the hundreds of thousands in this hideous war. Lest we forget. Indeed, it's important not to forget the lessons. In 1914, the war began, so 100 years later, the year 2014, the British had all kinds of memorials and eyes in Britain for some of this, where they were here you had poppies exploding. And I took this picture walking past the Tower of London, the oldest Norman construction in Britain, dating back to just shortly off 1066. And I wondered, what is this? And indeed, it was one of the most remarkable mobile growing war memorials of the First World War. On the centenary of the First World War, they planted over 800,000, over 880,000 poppies. These were ceramic poppies, and some capitalist obviously planned this because they sold these poppies for £10 each, and so each one was actually paid for by people who would, at the end of the memorial, take their poppies home. And so this was an income-generating memorial. They planted 880,000 poppies for the 880,000 British and Empire soldiers who died in the First World War. And they called them Seas of Blood. And it was to symbolize those who died in the sea, but you can see also those who died in the air. And because, of course, there was the beginning of the air war as well. And all arms of the services were gathered, and every night they would read out the names. So that people gathered every night at sunset and would hear the names of those who died being read in the last 5 months of 2014. And absolutely extraordinary. I don't know what you think when you see this. But when I saw it beginning, I saw red. I thought, what tremendous sacrifice, what a lot of courage, but what a waste. For what? Why? Why were Christians fighting one another? In 1914, Christians ruled the world. In 1914, Christians ruled overwhelmingly the world. But the only countries not under the control of Christians was the Ottoman Turkish Empire, which was crumbling, Japan, which was allied to Britain, and China, which was very weak. But the rest was Christian, either Orthodox in the case of Russia, or Catholic in the case of France and Italy and Austria, or Protestant in the case of the superpowers, Britain, Germany, and America. And to think that after the First World War, church attendance in Europe went from 64% church attendance before the First World War. It went down to 42% before the Second World War. It went down to 5% after the Second World War. This is what the two world wars did. They devastated Christianity in its heartland. And today, I don't think there's a single country in the world that you can call truly Christian anymore. And this is a sea of blood indeed. A memorial to the honor of those who died, and we should honor those who died. But the low-life, scheming, duplicitous politicians who sent them there, and who refused every effort at peace negotiations, and there was many a time that they could have ended the war, like Christmas 1914, for example. But no, they had to push ahead. My father, who was a bombardier in the 8th Army in North Africa, reported to me that they observed Christmas truces in North Africa. He said, oh no, every Christmas Eve. Now, never read this in any book. It's not reported in the history books. But my dad was under Field Marshal Montgomery in North Africa. He said, we respected the Africa Corps. They were gentlemen. And in fact, my grandfather was on the other side. My mother, Ingrid Lindemann, and her father, who was in the Africa Corps. And so my dad and my grandfather was opposite sides. And my father respected the Africa Corps. And I remember as a young boy hearing that my granddad was going to come to visit. And my father said the Germans were honorable men. They were gentlemen, decent people. And he'd say after some Hollywood films, I don't believe it. What? Don't you believe that? I don't believe any of it, he said. He said, my experience with Germans in North Africa is they were honorable men, gentlemen. I don't believe any of these atrocity stories at all. Well, interesting enough, when I heard that my grandfather was coming to visit, I wondered what was going to happen, and my brother and I were wondering, you know, what we wondered if a war would break out in the living room, because, you know, Dad and Grandad fought for another Second World War. But here's my grandfather, my father, my brother and I. They embraced one another. I remember just this extraordinary sense of what's going on here. Why did they fight one another, and yet they spoke with such glowing terms? The first thing they spoke about was the Christmas truce, and how they would sing hymns to one another. Now, that's in the Second World War, North Africa. Extraordinary. Well, there's another Christmas truce, which is worth paying attention to. It's an interesting book, A Higher Call, which I read a couple of years ago, and I'm making a major film in it right now. Incredible true story. The 379th bomber group from America, B-17s, were flying over to bomb Bremen, and on the way back, they got mauled by German Focke-Wulf fighters, and this B-17 was shot to pieces, and they went into a death spiral dive. The pilot was Charlie Brown, that's his actual name, Charlie Brown, and he went into death spiral, and he couldn't believe how he recovered, and he was so low to the ground, and he looks outside his cockpit, and he froze, blinked hard, looked again, hoping it's just a mirage, but they were staring at the most frightening scene. "This is a nightmare," the co-pilot said. "He's going to destroy us," the pilot agreed. The men were looking at a grey Messerschmitt 109 fighter cruising just a few feet away from the wingtip. It was 5 days before Christmas 1943, and the fighter had closed in on the crippled B-17 American bomber for the kill. The B-17 fighter bomber, Charlie Brown, was a 21-year-old West Virginia farmer. His bomber had been shot up in the skies above Germany after bombing Bremen. Half his crew was wounded. His tail gunner was dead. His blood was frozen over the rear machine guns. In fact, that's what had stopped. As Franz Steigler had approached from behind, he had his finger on, ready to fire, and he looked, why is the rear gunner not firing? Why is the guns depressed? And he went close and he saw the rear gunner's dead. And this whole plane is shot to pieces. He wondered, how is it still alive? Well, there's quite a few men in it. The rear gunner was dead. Half of the rest were all wounded. This whole B-17 was really quite a miracle. It's even up in the air. But when Brown and his co-pilot, Spencer Pinky Luke, looked at the German fighter pilot, they were amazed he didn't pull the trigger. He nodded, Brown said, escorted him out of German airspace, and it's one of the most remarkable acts of chivalry. The Messerschmitt pilot, who was Franz Steigler, saluted, led him out over the North Sea, and because he knew he needed to guide him out, because this man was going deep into Germany, didn't know the right way out, he guided him out, and because he's escorting him, the German anti-aircraft defenses at the North Sea didn't open fire, and then he guided him towards Britain and saluted and left him to continue on his way. Years later, Brown would track down his erstwhile enemy for a reunion that reduced both men to tears. His encounter with the German fighter pilot is told in A Higher Call. And I've been through this book, and it's absolutely extraordinary. The book explains how this aerial encounter reverberated through both their lives for over 50 years. The war left them in turmoil. When they found each other, they found peace. Their story is extraordinary, but it's not unique. There were many acts of kindness and mercy extended to enemies during the war. British and German troops gathered for post-war reunions, some vacationed together after both world wars. Take Douglas Bader, one of Britain's top fighter aces. In fact, his legs were tin legs, aluminium legs. He was shot down over Germany, and Adolf Garland, one of the top German fighter aces on the other side, befriended him. Here's Adolf Garland, there's Douglas Bader. And this is the famous Messerschmitt of Adolf Garland, one of the top German fighters. Notice he's got Mickey Mouse, as is indicated. And these are all his victories on his tail. He had a tremendous amount of victories. He became officer commanding all the fighter ace, all the fighters of Germany. So this is, in fact, one of the ones signed by Adolf Garland and Douglas Bader. Because they became friends, they wrote the forewords for one another's books. And this is after one of the escape attempts of Douglas Bader and Adolf Garland leading him in. I remember reading this book when I was a youngster. I was still only about 12 years old. The First and the Last by Adolf Garland. And to me, it was just extraordinary reading about people like Douglas Bader and Adolf Garland. And here they are as good friends meeting late in life. And they would vacation together. And there's many other examples. Erwin Rommel's son and the son of Field Marshal Montgomery became best of friends, and they vacationed together with their families. So these are just some of the Sky Warriors. And in fact, they both were official advisors for the Battle of Britain Corps. Now, this is the story of Franz Steigler, though. Franz Steigler was a German fighter ace who had fought in North Africa in the Africa Corps. He was a fighter ace who had shot down many aircraft. In fact, on the very day that he encountered Charlie Brown, he had already shot down two B-17s. He was on the ground refueling, getting more ammunition, and he saw this B-17 flying overhead, so low, he thought first it was going to land, then he saw, goodness me, this plane shouldn't be even afloat. It looks shot to pieces. But revenge, not honor, is what drove Second Lieutenant Franz Steigler to jump into his cockpit that chilly December day 1943, and it was, I believe, the 19th of December. Steigler was not just any fighter pilot, he was an ace. One more kill and he'd win the Knight's Cross, the highest award for valor, which you got when you hit the magic number of, I think it was 40 at that stage. They pushed the number up later on the war. Yet Steigler was driven by something deeper than glory. His older brother, August, was a Luftwaffe night fighter who had been killed early in the war. An American pilot had killed several of Steigler's comrades and were bombing his country cities. This is his brother, August, who was a night fighter and who had died in the war earlier. And, of course, coming back from North Africa, which was an honorable war, and seeing his cities laid waste by these bomber raids, 1,000 bomber raids, Steigler's blood boiled and he just wanted to shoot down American and British bombers. He had already shot down two B-17 fighter bombers that day, and he was refueling, reloading, when he saw this B-17 flying so low. As the bomber disappeared from view behind some trees, he saluted the ground crew, took off in hot pursuit. But as he rose to meet the bomber, as he maneuvered to attack, he climbed behind the bomber, squinted into his gun sight, placed his hand on the trigger. He was about to fire when he hesitated. He was baffled. No one had fired at him. That never happened to him before. He looked closer at the tail gunner, who was still, his white fleece collar soaked with blood. He went even closer, craned his neck to examine the rest of the bomber, which was ripped to pieces. Its skin had been peeled away by shells, its guns were knocked out. He could see men huddled inside the plane, tending to the wounds of other crew. Then he nudged his plane alongside the bomber's wings, locked eyes with the pilot. His eyes were wide with shock and horror. Steigler pressed his hand over the cross that he kept in his flight jacket. And he prayed for a moment and then eased his finger off the trigger. He couldn't shoot. And by the way, at that moment, Charlie Brown says, his hand went to his Gideon Bible in his top pocket. I mean, here's two Christians on opposite sides. And God stopped them. He could not shoot. Franz Steigler understood it would be dishonorable to shoot at a crippled enemy aircraft, even if it was a bomber. Steigler was not only motivated by vengeance that day, he lived by a code of honor. He could trace his family's ancestry to the knights of the 16th century. He had once studied theology. Steigler recalled the voice of his commanding officer once told him, "You follow the rules of war for yourself, not for the enemy. You fight by rules to keep your humanity." Alone with a crippled bomber, Steigler changed his mission. He nodded at the American pilot, began to fly in formation so German anti-aircraft gunners on the ground would not shoot down the slow-moving bomber because it was under his protection, guidance, maybe surrendered. Germany, in fact, had captured some of these bombers, so it could even be a German piloted plane for all they knew. And he was pretty sure this bomber would not survive flying as low as it was going over the anti-aircraft guns at the North Sea. Steigler escorted the bomber over the North Sea, took one last look at the pilot, saluted him, peeled his pilot away, returned to Germany. And he said, "God, good luck, you're in God's hands now." Well, as he watched the German Messerschmitt 109 peel away that December day, Second Lieutenant Charles Brown wasn't thinking of the philosophical connection between enemies. He was thinking of survival. He didn't know how he'd reach Britain alive and if they'd survive. And as he came within Britain's sight, American fighters were scrambled to escort them in. He flew back to base, landed with barely any fuel left, and as the bomber came to stop, he leaned back in his chair and put his hand over his Gideon's pocket Bible and his flight jacket and sat in silence. Here's some of his crew. His commander, he reported the event to his commander, who strictly forbade him to ever talk about the incident. It was considered dangerous for morale. Brown flew more missions before the war ended. He got married. He had two daughters. Supervised foreign aid for the U.S. State Department during the Vietnam War. Eventually retired to Florida. Here's some of their crew. And Charlie Brown enjoying a bottle of whiskey and a cigar when his final mission was complete. I think American bombers had to do 24 missions before they were allowed to return to home. Late in life, the encounter with the German pilot began to annoy him. He began to have nightmares. But in his dream, there'd be no act of mercy, and he had awakened just before his bomber crashed. So he took on a new mission. He had to find this German pilot. Who was he? And why did he save my life? What he discovered was blood-curdling and inspiring, because Franz Steigler was a top German fighter ace who was one of the first of the Jager 44 jet fighters, one of the first jet fighters in history. And these are some of the Messerschmitt 262s, the most advanced fighter bomber jets in the world at that time. And here's Jager 44. This was the Flight of Eagles. These were the top of the best. These were some of the most legendary names in the German Air Force. It included people like Adolf Garland and Lützow and Günther von Malzahn. And Lützow became one of the top leaders in the new German Luftwaffe after War II. Colonel Hannes Traloft. Almost all these people, Knight's Cross awards. Hoeger. And this Steinhoff, Major Steinhoff, headed in the end the head of the German Air Force after the war, the reconstructed German Luftwaffe. He was burned so badly in a crash landing with a Messerschmitt 262. He was, his whole body was aflame. It's extraordinary he's even alive. But he's a legend as well. And Major Gert Barkhorn, who had over 300 kills, one of the top fighter aces of the war. The Messerschmitt 262 in action, and they took down a lot of American and British B-17s and the British Lancasters. This was technology of a high order, and so Steigler was one of the best of the best. And what his units did was, without fuel, without supplies, with inadequate supply parts, not all the right materials, and many times these Messerschmitt 262 sat on a runway because there's no fuel for them to take off on. But when they did have a chance to take off, they caused havoc with the flying fortresses and the bombers around them. So when he discovered the person that had shown mercy to him, he was even more amazed. Well, on January the 18th, 1990, Brown received a letter, opened it and read. He had scoured military archives in Britain and America. He attended a pilot's reunion, shared a story, and he finally placed an ad in a German newspaper for former Luftwaffe pilots retelling a story and asking, does anyone know the pilot? And then he got this letter from Franz Steigler. Dear Charles, all these years I wondered what happened to B-17. Did she make it or not? It was Steigler. He had left Germany after the war. He had moved to Vancouver, Canada in 1953. He became a prosperous businessman. Now retired, Steigler told Brown he'd be in Florida the next summer. It sure would be nice to talk about our encounter. And Brown was so excited, he couldn't wait to see Steigler. He called Directory Assistance for Vancouver, asked whether there's a number for Franz Steigler, dialed the number, and spoke to Steigler personally. And he had to thank him. He wrote a letter saying, to say thank you, thank you, thank you, on behalf of my surviving crew members and their families appears totally inadequate. The two pilots met again, but this time in the lobby in a Florida hotel. One of Brown's friends was there to record the summer reunion, and you can Google and watch it. Both men looked like retired businessmen, plump, sporting neat ties, formal shorts. They talked about the encounter in a light, jovial tone. And then the mood changed. Someone asked Steigler what he thought about Brown. Steigler sighed. His square jaw tightened. He began to fight back tears. And he said, "I love you, Charlie." Steigler had lost his brother, his friends, and his country. He was virtually exiled by his countrymen after the war. There are only 28,000 pilots who fought for the German Air Force, and of those, only 1,200 survived the war. Brown and Steigler became friends. They'd take fishing trips together. They'd fly cross-country to each other's homes. They took road trips together to share their story at schools and veterans' reunions. Their wives became good friends. Brown's daughter says her father would worry about Steigler's health and constantly check up on him. And it wasn't just for show, she said. They really did feel for each other, and they talked about once a week. And as his friendship deepened, something else happened. His daughter said, "The nightmares went away." Brown had written a letter of thanks to Steigler, but one day he showed the extent of his gratitude. He organized a reunion of his surviving crew members, along with their extended families, invited Steigler as a guest of honor. And I've seen this on Google as well, where they meet. During the reunion, it shows all the faces of people that now have children, grandchildren, relatives, who were only alive because Steigler spared that B-17, which was crippled and at his mercy. And Steigler watched the film from a seat of honor. And as I said, everyone was crying, not just him. Steigler and Brown died within months of each other in 2008. Steigler was 92 and Brown was 87. They started off as enemies, became friends, and then a lot more. And Marcos, the author of this book, discovered by accident, poking through Brown's house, and he came across a book on German fighter jets. Steigler had given the book to Brown. Now, they were both country boys who grew up to fly planes. Marcos opened the book and saw an inscription Steigler had written to Brown. "In 1940, I lost my only brother as a night fighter. On the 20th of December, 4 days before Christmas, I had the chance to save a B-17 from her destruction, a plane so badly damaged it was a wonder that she was flying. The pilot, Charlie Brown, is for me as precious as my brother was." Thank you, Charlie, your brother, Franz. How is that even possible? That people who were deadly enemies could have become more precious than brothers. And it's very hard to understand for people who haven't been in war. It's hard for me to understand because I've never fought fellow Christians like my father did. But one can only imagine. If they would have known what would become of their countries, they'd never have fought against each other. They would have fought side by side against a real enemy. Harry Patch was the oldest surviving Tommy soldier of the First World War in the British Isles. He died very recently. And Harry Patch was continually paraded out there because he was the last surviving British frontliners. And you had people like Tony Blair and Prime Minister Brown and others trying to use him. And he was disgusted. He said, "I felt then as I feel now that the politicians who took us to war should have been given their guns and told to settle their differences themselves instead of organizing nothing better than legalized mass murder." Harry Patch said, "I was a conscientious objector, but I knew I couldn't afford to say I was because they were shooting conscientious objectors, putting them against the wall and shooting them. So I and a group of others in our unit, we made a pact amongst ourselves that we'd never aim to kill, we'd never kill a fellow human being. And so we went to the trenches, we endured the bombardments, we took the punishments and so on of both sides, but we deliberately made sure we did not ever kill anyone on the other side." And he said this publicly, he said, "Don't you use me to promote your wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and all these other things." He said, "You would have put me against the wall and shot me if you knew what my beliefs were back then. Don't pretend that I'm there to glamorize your organized wars for political ends." So Harry Patch, interesting, he's the last surviving British soldier of the First World War, combat soldier. And but he said, "I never shot anyone in my years in the war, and don't use me to glamorize your war." Thomas Paine said, "He who dares not offend cannot be honest." And the Christmas truce exposed a whole lot of things. It exposed the lies of the propaganda that demonized the enemies. And so you see these kind of posts more commonly these days. Next time we fight it side by side. And in fact, isn't it interesting? Britain fought people who weren't their enemies, but now they're allowing people who hate everything they stand for to come in, and they pay for them. Behead those insulters at Islam. Liberalism, go to hell. Kill those insulters at Islam. While your children are learning to tolerate their children are training to kill your children. Therefore, gird yourself up manfully and take up joyful arms for the name of God, said Bernard of Clairvaux, organizer of the Second Crusade. You just think, after hundreds of years of fighting as overwhelming odds against radical Islam, saving Europe, now you've got a whole lot of people who want you to be praying towards Mecca and so on. But where's the crusading spirit? The crusaders fought Islam, and now Islam's being welcomed into places like Britain, and if you speak up against it, you're guilty of a thought crime. Have they forgotten what happened to Constantinople? Centuries of fighting for Christian civilization against Islam. The Polish lancers at the Battle of Vienna, 11th of November, 1683. And now what's time or slime celebrating? The child-free life. And National Geographic, the new Europeans. How waves of immigrants are reshaping the continent. These aren't new Europeans. These are Arabs. Arabs are not Europeans. And so, on the left, scenes of the old British bobbies, the way they used to be, and what they now look like. Because, you see, now you can get stab-proof vests for ages 11 to 18 from only £19.99. The store of modern childhood. Diversity makes us stronger. Diversity, indeed. These are some of the Muslim rapist grooming gangs that were allowed for decades to rape 1 million English girls without prosecution because the police and the Child Protection Service were afraid of following it up despite thousands of complaints because they didn't want to be called racist. 1 million English girls raped over a 20-year period by Pakistani and other Muslim grooming gangs, and yet somehow or another the British police, judicial system, child protection services refused to get involved, looked the other way, turned a blind eye, because the last thing I'd want to do is be called a racist. They say the average European today would rather be raped or stabbed than called a racist. And this is what Christmas shopping looks like in France today, because of diversity. And you wonder why Poland's objecting and why they're marching in Germany against stop the Islamization of Europe. Of course, these are all thought crimes. How can you possibly suggest there's something intolerant or violent about Islam? Expel the Islamists. It's time to rediscover crusading spirit. Islam out of Europe. Dies Wut. It is the will of God. Our heritage is Christian. The cathedrals, the stones proclaim our Christian heritage. And Merry Christmas. If these guys can get along, you can make it through dinner with your relatives. By the word merry means steadfast, strong, virulent. It's a term used for fighting men. So you read in Shakespeare about the merry men means the soldiers, the fighting men, formidable soldiers. And Robin Hood and his merry men didn't mean they were laughing all the time. It meant they were strong and powerful. So they spoke about merry weather when they're talking about a storm. It would be merry weather. And so I think the term merry has lost a lot of its Shakespearean meaning today. It remains an extraordinary testimony to the power of the gospel that during such a terrible time of world war, soldiers of so many armies on opposite sides could stop fighting, come out of their trenches, and embrace the enemies and honor the Prince of Peace. This was a miracle in human sense. I've got the Christmas truce that we produced on the 100th anniversary of it, a Christian Action newsletter on the table. If you want to take, they're available on the Christian Action website as well, if you want to share them with others. It's important for us to understand the context of our history, discover the real facts, the real people, and the real history, so that we might counter Satan's deception of the nations, especially through Hollywood. We need to remind people why men still seek Christ. Put Christ back into Xmas. This is the season, the wreath, but this is the reason when you look at the crown of thorns. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. So we videoed this through screen capture, and we'll put it up on our website so we can share this with others about the Christmas truce. We've got the article up on the website. It's so important that people know this. It puts the propaganda in perspective. So, any comments, any questions?
I like Rudyard Kipling's poems. No, not anymore, I guess.
Well, Rudyard Kipling at least was honest enough to admit that he was a warmonger and he caused his own son's death. Okay. And the death of many hundreds of thousands of other sons. He was conscripted. In fact, I think he volunteered to be a propagandist in the First World War. So he would cook up the most debased ideas to demonize the enemy, to inspire people to support the war, even though he knew they were lies. Of course, we're coming up this Saturday, Handel's Messiah, the oldest Protestant church in the Southern Hemisphere, Strand Street Lutheran. So on Saturday nights, the Cape Town Symphony Orchestra is singing Handel's Messiah. I think Handel's Messiah is one of the excellent traditions of Christmas. Sorry? Sadly not. Although they say it goes to charity, but yeah, definitely not. We will try to have it filmed too. So, some of our other events on the First World War. We've produced quite a bit on the First World War, I must say. So any comments, observations? By the way, I thought it was interesting looking at the satellite picture how green our section of the Cape Peninsula is, but the moment you get over the mountains, how dry it is in the rest of the Western Cape. Just shows a bit of a difference. But also notice how the Cape Flats is very dry. But that's because they've deforested it. But where we've got the forest, you can see quite a lot of greenery. And then, but you can see what human habitation has devastated a lot of the Cape Peninsula. And of course, we recently had the Day of the Covenant, and I thought you'd be interested to know they had the largest turnout ever for Day of the Covenant at the Fort Rucker Monument. These are some nice pictures of some of the old Fort Rucker uniforms. And this is some of the official pictures of the, apparently, I just don't remember the numbers, it was colossal. They couldn't fit the people in. There's just too many people at the Fort Rucker Monument for the Day of the Vow. So, comments, questions?
So this, what you were mentioning is the importance also of that the people must know this truth. And that because information is actually very powerful.
Yes. If the people at that time had known, they wouldn't have gone to fight fellow Christians. Let alone to support a terrorist sponsoring nation like Serbia assassinating the Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie. I mean, why were we on the wrong side? And why did we fight for so long? And for what? And what good came out of it? And yet, you get Muslims pouring into Britain, raping British children, and they don't. And yet they will spend the police energy to look at someone posting a Facebook posting that could be considered critical of Islam and then charging them for Islamophobia. Instead of dealing with rapists and murderers, they have something like a knife attack every 90 minutes in London right now. And so, and machete attacks are on a rampage in Britain. The British police used to not even carry a weapon. And now they've got to go armed like they look like they're going to war. And in fact, the streets of London are now more dangerous than the streets of New York. And English people are minority in London. And I've got a Muslim mayor in London. And you could continue. But they went to war over what? With their friends and relatives. But they can't even protect their own people in their own island from Islamic terrorists. You know, what would Richard the Lionheart say? Whose flag they fly. You know, it's just bizarre. So we've got something really messed up. Europe put all the energy into fighting one another, and they seem to have no more energy to fight the real enemies. You know, you shouldn't go to war if you don't have to. But when you have to fight, you go fight. And it just seems they fought the wrong enemies in the 20th century, and they haven't bothered to fight the real ones. And that's the way I'm coming to see it.
I was watching on DSTV the First World War. They got leave for the first time after 4 years. That guy's been in the streets for 4 years.
Sure.
Before they got leave. Can 7 days leave. I mean, that's just crazy.
It's just wicked.
During that bombardment, like that day in and day out.
And the health conditions. Shocking. Trench foot. People, there where their skin was peeling off because their feet were underwater most of the time. They didn't have proper drainage and things like that. Yeah. Conditions in trenches were a nightmare. But just think, gas attacks, machine gun fire, flamethrowers, tanks, bombs from the air. It must have seemed to people like Armageddon had arrived. You know, this must seem like the end of the world for these poor people. And just living in this constant cloud of smoke, and in where they start the war in forest, and there's not a tree left, everything's bombed to pieces. And like the South African division that marched into Delville Wood, they marched thousands in, and only a couple of hundred came out. And the entire forest was destroyed. Just sticks left, not a leaf left. Yes, and they took some poor springbok there. Shame. I mean, that's just like not fair. So.
It makes you wonder how they survived those bombardments. 10 days of bombardments. But I mean,
you've got to dig. But yeah, I mean, that's just another reason why it's wrong to put women into the army, because they should have the body strength to dig a trench fast in hard ground, or to pick up someone with his full kit and run. Person's wounded. It's not right to expect women who are meant to nurture and save life to be killers anyway. But what kind of low-life scum men send women into combat? Oh, it's people like Clinton and Obama who never went to the army themselves. They're the ones who put women into combat. It's a sick world now. We've got women going into combat and wimpy men becoming presidents. Did I say men?
Yeah.
Males. Forgive me. How can I call people like Clinton and Obama men? Blah. Now, it's just... Clinton, I think, was the first one to put women in combat. Of course, he was a draft dodger.
No, it's so ridiculous. If you put a woman in the unit, then they all act strange.
Yes.
Then the one falls in love with her, doesn't want anyone else to talk to her. It starts to...
Then he hates his friend.
Then it's madness. You know, you just can't put a woman in amongst men on the front lines.
Well, in the ships, they used to have it that you can't have a woman on a battleship.
Yeah.
And now the Navy's got co-ed situations, which is apparently chaos. Yeah, no, that's... Well, I don't know if you've seen a picture also of the ministers of war in Europe. And all the East Europeans, they've got these tough-looking men where you wouldn't want to argue with them.
Yeah.
And then the whole of Western Europe seems to have women as ministers of defense.
Yeah.
And they all look like fashion models.
Yeah.
And you think, yeah, that's not exactly the way it's meant to be. But no wonder Europe's not defending themselves. Got people feeling sorry for the enemies instead of actually defending their country.
It's how worked it out, man. It's these movies they're showing the young boys.
Yeah.
You know, like Charlie's Angel, the woman's got arms this thin and she's knocking out a green beret.
Yeah.
You know, it's like...
Even Terminator.
That is just nonsense, isn't it?
In the Terminator movies, next thing you've got these women beating up at Schwarzenegger.
Yeah. It's not true, you know. Anybody that's been in a situation, you know that's not true. You hit one of those guys and say, what was that?
Yes, so the women are being encouraged to be masculine, the men are being encouraged to be feminine.
It's not true, it's a lie. The modern is all a lie, that type of stuff. So in real life, that doesn't happen. You can't knock out a guy if you haven't got the weight, and you know, even if you know how to fight. That's why you've got different weight differences in boxing, because weight is a huge difference. A big heavyweight will always beat a small guy. Always. It doesn't matter how good a fight is. You know what I mean? The weight and strength always count. You know what I mean? So the stronger you are, it always comes. You know, it's that crazy.
That's also true in sword fighting, that a person may have good technique, but brute strength can often just cut straight through the whole thing.
I was watching some of those knife fights on those medieval knife fights on DSTV. Knife fights, you know, that they do. It's true, the big strong guys just wait out the guys.
Yeah, because this like the fencing idea where you start fighting, oh no, but he had right of way, so your point doesn't count. In a fight, it doesn't work like that. And also, a technical point doesn't mean that much when, okay, you might have touched them, but that's not equal to a person bludgeoning you, which is why Richard the Lionheart went in with his battle axe.
Yeah.
And he could take 200 knights, charge into 6,000 Arabs, and win. Also, the Crusaders were much bigger, stronger, and healthier than Arabs,
yeah,
and much taller. And their horses were double the size and weight of the Arab horses, and they'd specifically bred them to be stronger and stronger, to be able to handle them with the armor on their horses. And so, in a massed attack, as Richard Lionheart proved, 200 fully armored knights charging into 6,000 Arabs could win. They said they could. Their horses would trample over the Arab horses. They would just bludgeon and push them. It didn't matter what they did, and they had light armor. And also the Arabs with their arrows, they kept shooting in. And apparently, many of these knights in the end, they looked like pincushions. They had all these arrows, but none of them had reached their skin because of their link chainmail and so on. So they'd afterwards be, you know, sort of cutting off all these arrows that are sticking out all over the place. And they said that the Arabs trust in their arms, but we trust in our armor. And so they would, and they had the weight and the strength to do it. And they spoke about Richard going in and with one hit of his battle axe, cleaving Arabs straight through the armor, straight through the helmet, smashing through the sword, smashing through the shields. So in a case like that, strength and weight counts for a heap more than technique and all the rest of it. I think they were good at that.
Yeah.
Yes. Good. Any other comments? I think the Christmas truce is an inspiring thing to remind people. There is nothing else on the planet that could have stopped nations involved in the most devastating war in history from stopping except the Prince of Peace. And so, I mean, what else could have done it? Do you think Mickey Mouse, Disney, Muhammad, Charles Darwin, Richard Dawkins, could anybody else inspire a complete ceasefire across entire fronts between some of the most powerful armies the world's ever seen? Only Jesus Christ has brought about things like this. You won't see anything like this in the annals of Islam or Buddhism or anything else like that. And this is where the rubber meets the road. Christ has the power to break the spear and the bow and the shield, and he can speak the word, "Be still and know that I'm God." And even the armies had to keep quiet. Even the artillery had to be silent. It's just a powerful picture of when the Lord returns, imagine. I mean, that was just like a whisper. But when he returns, he'll annihilate the armies of Antichrist. It's just, there's no way anyone can fight against God and win. So you want to be on the winning side. You don't want to. Antichrist is doomed. He hasn't got a snowball's chance in hell against the King of Kings. And we just need to remind people who's the winning side.
Just to remind people, God didn't in this case need to bark orders to get the people to stop fighting.
This is just like a whisper. Yeah. Yes, I mean, imagine when the Lord returns, you'll have even the kings and the enemy's armies bowing down in worship before him because they can do nothing else.
You said that the Germans and Russians also stopped and celebrated Christmas. Were Russians not communists at the time?
No, no, not in 1914. No, the communists took over Russia in 1917. So
the Germans let Lenin go.
Yes.
Then they let him go. The Germans had him.
Yes. Lenin. Well, actually, Lenin was in exile in Zurich. And Lenin asked permission to be allowed across. And one of the most foolish things ever done by an intelligence agency, the Kaiser's intelligence unit thought, oh, Lenin's a troublemaker. Let him go in a sealed railway carriage across, and then they'd let him go over to Finland, and from Finland he would go into St. Petersburg, and he'd cause trouble in Russia. And of course, what a short-sighted idea. It's like America helping Osama bin Laden to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. It's not intelligent, because what's he going to do afterwards? That's like short-term vision. Yeah, right. Somebody pointed out the very interesting thing that in Vienna, at one point, within 1 kilometer, this is before the First World War, you had Lenin, Hitler, Stalin, and Sigmund Freud all living within 1 kilometer, and they frequented 2 coffee shops amongst these 4 people. There were some other famous people also, but to think they were all in Vienna at one point. Well, when I was in Zurich, I was shown this is where Lenin stayed, and Lenin's apartment was not even 100 meters from where Zwingli's house was. And I think in a place of reformation that to call him a serpent is an insult to serpents. that such a poisonous individual could have resided in the protection of a reformed enclave like Zurich. Very disturbing. But also to think that our side, Christians, could help the enemy without always realizing where they were going to be in the end. Yeah. One needs long-term vision.